Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced.
Well, they're at it again. They are at it again. The cons, I'm telling you, is our economy for we the people, or is it for multinational corporations? I mean, whether it's Halliburton deciding that they're going to become a Dubai company, but they still want U.S. contracts, or whether it is U.S. South Korea talks, these trade talks, TXU, this deal, there is some just extraordinary, frankly, extraordinarily revealing economic news today that I want to share with you that brings us back to this question. Is the economy, does an economy exist for those who play the game in it? Or does it exist for society as a whole that allows it, that allows the game players in an economy to participate and play the game of business in the economy? Which is it? I mean, this is one of the fundamental questions that cleaves conservatives from liberals, I would submit to you. And then that is that many conservatives, probably the vast majority of conservatives, would say that society exists to serve an economy. That those people who play the game of business in an economy are the ones who have the right to control the economy and receive most of the benefits of the economy. And if stuff falls off the table, the crumbs are for the peons. And on the other hand, liberals would say, and going all the way back to George Washington, that an economy, that the structural parts of the economy, those people who are participating in the economy, those people who are playing the game of business in the economy, are doing so at the pleasure of society. In other words, we the people collectively get together and say, we're going to determine the rules by which you can play in this game called capitalism and free enterprise and the American economy and the world economy for that matter. And that those rules have to be done in a way that's going to help all of us. It's just, you know, fundamental stuff. And so I want to dig in a little bit to a couple of news stories that were in today's Wall Street Journal that particularly provoked me. But first, just a quick heads up. I thought this was really interesting. The thing I thought was perhaps most interesting about this was the response. Mark Green, the new president of Air America Radio, has suggested, because the Democratic Party in Nevada, and, you know, a tip of the hat to John Edwards for starting this process, for saying no, because the Democratic Party in Nevada has said no to Fox News. And John Edwards was the first to say, no, I won't participate if Fox News is moderating the debate. Fine, you guys go ahead and have your debate. I will participate in other debates in Nevada, but not one moderated by Fox News, because they're not a real news channel. They don't do news, they do commentary. And, you know, a legitimate news organization, fine, I'll be there. But Fox News is not a legitimate news organization. Now, I'm not quoting him verbatim, but that was the gist of it. And so Mark Green suggested to the Republicans that they could differentiate themselves from Democrats by having Air America. Well, here's the entire letter. Dear Republican Chairman Ray Hoffman of Iowa, Republican Chairman goes to the Republican chairmans of Iowa, Nevada, South Carolina, and New Hampshire. He says, as the new president of Air America, I'd like to offer to co-host one of your upcoming presidential debates. And then he goes through why. And he says, it would allow Republicans to differentiate themselves from Democrats, embracing a debate hosted by a progressive media outlet after Nevada Democrats canceled. And see, that's the point, the progressive media outlet part. This was posted this morning. This letter that Mark Green wrote was posted over at Politico.com. which kind of represents itself as a nonpartisan blog, but you look at, or a website, you look at all the bloggers and all the responses, and you get it that it's, at least their readers certainly have a right-wing tilt to them. And reading through the responses, one of the responses says, this was Todd, he replied to this thing this morning at 11 o'clock, he says, since when is Air America a legitimate news organization? Last time I checked, Fox News doesn't have hosts who defame, insult, and otherwise attempt to humiliate those who don't agree with their political point of view. Todd, I think you got the point and you missed the point. Air America is not, now I can't speak for Air America, and I certainly can't speak for Mark Green, wouldn't want to try. You know, he, big boy, can speak for himself, but speaking at for myself, I don't put myself out as a news person. I mean, I did news for 7 years back many, you know, several decades ago. I have been a news person, but I am a commentator. I'm here to share my take with you. And that's the whole point. Fox News is pretending to be a news organization when, in fact, they're the official house organ of the Republican Party, or the unofficial house organ. And for Todd to say, last time I checked, Fox News doesn't have hosts who defame, insult, and otherwise attempt to humiliate those who don't agree with their political point of view. Well, first of all, defame, insult, and otherwise attempt to humiliate, it's fairly strong language. At least on this show, I don't think you'll find a lot of that. But, you know, what the heck? I don't think that Todd has been watching, for example, Mr. O'Reilly. I mean, it's a, or Mr. Mr. Hannity, for that matter, or any of the others. I mean, it's, come on. If Fox News is providing political commentary, Air America Radio provides political commentary. If you're going to have organizations that provide political commentary hosting political events like primaries, bring us in. Bring us in. We're here. And I think we could do a very good job. And speaking from experience, actually, I hosted the gubernatorial primary debate here in the state of Oregon, where the sitting Democratic governor was being challenged by two other candidates, and the former state treasurer and a county commissioner, and I thought I did a pretty good job. So it's possible, it happens, it's done all the time. But back to economics. I just wanted to put that out. I think it's an interesting way. We'll see how this all shakes out. It's going to be real interesting to see how the Republican Party responds to this. Evan Ramstead today in the Wall Street Journal is the author of a news piece. This is actually pretty much as straight news. The headline, U.S.-South Korea talks stumble. The U.S. and South Korea failed to agree on lower barriers to trade in food and automobiles, increasing the risk that they will miss a March 31 deadline for negotiating a free trade pact. Now, first of all, I suspect that most Americans assume that because starting with Ronald Reagan and continuing with George W. Bush, but every single president, frankly, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, all four of them have contributed to this, that we have been kicking wide open the doors of this country and saying, yeah, free trade, no problem. We'll get rid of all our tariffs. We're not going to protect our economy in any way. Multinational corporations rule and set the rules. You know, the WTO, GATT, NAFTA, all of that. I think most Americans have assumed that every other country in the world has done the same. Well, you've assumed wrong. And they probably assumed that our major trading partners like China or South Korea or Japan have done the same, and you've assumed wrong. As a matter of fact, the president and Republicans and many Democratic members of Congress, actually, this is an area where I part company with many Democrats, are trying to get a so-called free trade deal with South Korea. Right now, if South Korea wants to sell cars into the United States, we have a tariff on imported cars of a little less than 2%. But if we want to sell cars in South Korea, they have an import tariff of 7 to 8%. If we want to sell food into South Korea, they have a 52% tariff. Their overall average import tariff in South Korea is 11%. Our overall average import tariff is 3.7%. And so what's the result of this? We buy lots of stuff from them because it's cheap. They don't buy much stuff from us at all, and there's this huge imbalance. For example, South Korea exported $10 billion worth of cars, trucks, and parts to the U.S. last year. How much did we export to them? Less than $1 billion worth, $750 million worth. Now, you know, what's the significance of this, and why should anybody even understand what the word tariff means? I think this is actually a very big deal. and a very significant one. And it also ties in with what TXU is up to, the Texas this Texas power company that Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts is going after. And I'm going to pull all these things together and make sense of it right after this break, particularly in the context of the history of tariffs in the United States. Then we'll take your calls and talk about, you know, what's the purpose of an economy? Is it to serve us, or are we here to serve it? 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Air America Radio, Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. I should have set this up a little better. Let me just restart, because I got off on that Fox News screed and sort of derailed the topic. The United States, when we first started out, when we first started this country, 1787, the Constitution was first written. It wasn't ratified until 2 years later, 1789. There was a small businessman by the name of Tench Cox. There's only been one biography written of him, about him. It was actually commissioned by his family back in the 1950s. And it turns out, and I've read it, it's fascinating, actually. This guy was the original American entrepreneur. He was a small businessman. He was not particularly wealthy. In fact, nobody was. The first millionaire by today, you know, using today's dollars, the first millionaire in today's dollars, or at least in about 1980 dollars, when the guy did the measurement, the book that did the measurement, Forrest McDonald, I believe it was. The first millionaire was in 1790, you know, long after the Revolution. There were some multimillionaires in the United States prior to the Revolutionary War. They all went back to either Canada, like the Johnson family, or to England. So it was mostly a nation of entrepreneurs and small business people who had just overthrown the British East India Company and the empire that spawned and supported it. And Tench Cox came forward and he suggested a piece of legislation that became one of our first laws, which had one of these long, you know, 35-word names, as legislation did back in those days, you know, a bill to protect the businesses of the United States of America and all the people, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't remember the title of it. But the point of it was that the bottom line, that there were some industries, first of all, there were some industries that we felt we really needed to grow, that if we were dependent upon the British or the French for anything from musket balls to horseshoes, that we might be in deep trouble should we ever come into conflict with them again, as we did. And so, number one, there were industries that were essential to the national defense, just to the nation. And number two, and this is perhaps most important from the point of view of Tench Cox, the small businessman, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Boston, and you want to import a pair of shoes from Guatemala, where it might be 50 cents worth of labor, or from China, where it might be 10 cents worth of labor, well, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. We wouldn't want to. Trade is a fine thing. But when those shoes appear at the U.S. border, if they come from Guatemala, where there's 50 cents worth of labor, we're going to add a 50-cent tax. So it still costs you a dollar to bring those shoes in. And if they come from China, where there's 10 cents worth of labor, we're going to add a 90-cent tax. So it still costs you a dollar. So it's going to cost you a dollar to make a pair of shoes in terms of the labor cost, whether you make them here, whether you make them in Guatemala, or whether you make them in China. Doesn't matter. It's going to cost you a dollar. Where do you want to make the shoes? And most manufacturers said, gee, I think I'll make them here. And that's why for 200 years in the United States, we had a shoe industry. That's why for 200 years in the United States, we made jeans. That's why for 200 years in the United States, we made coats. We made clothes. We made shirts. We made pants. We made everything. You know, computer. We don't even make computers in the United States anymore. We made televisions. We invented them here in the United States. We made radios in the United States. All kinds of things. We made them here because if you imported them from cheaper labor countries, you had to pay an import tariff that equaled the spread in the cost of the labor, or in some cases, a few other variables. And this was so important to the United States that 100% of the federal government's budget, from the founding of this country until the Civil War, 100% of our budget, of the federal budget, came from imports, came from tariffs, rather. 100%. It was two-thirds of the entire federal government budget up until World War I. It was one-third of the imports represent, or tariffs rather, represented one-third of the entire federal budget up until World War II. And it was a still a significant portion of our budget right up through the 1980s. And then we began deconstructing these tariffs and going into this era of the world is flat, Thomas Friedman, neoliberalism. And if you look at what's happened in South and Central America over the last 20, 25 years, as they have, in many cases, were actually forced by the IMF to embrace this so-called neoliberalism, this conservative economic policies is what I would refer to it as, and do away with tariffs and do away with, quote, protectionism. They were averaging a growth rate from the 1960s to, from 1960 to 1980 of around 86%. It's not wonderful, but it's pretty good. Since 1980, what the South and Central America have been averaging, Latin America as a region has been averaging around 6% growth. Total over the entire period, 6 to 8%. I mean, it's falling apart. It doesn't work. And the same thing is happening in the United States. In the 26 years since Reagan began this process, and certainly since Clinton kicked the doors open, what is happening is that the middle class is vanishing and the big multinational corporations are making out very well, thank you very much. And so you get Halliburton saying, well, hey, we don't need to be in the United States anymore. There's no barriers. There's no trade. There's no borders for all practical purposes in terms of law. So we'll just go to Dubai. We don't have to keep business records. We're not accountable. We don't have all these stupid laws that we have to deal with. We don't have to, we can do anything we want. And you get that. You get this whole situation here with South Korea. Now, Bush is trying to get this through before June 30th. Because his ability to shove a trade deal down the throat of Congress expires on June 30th. We need to let it expire, by the way. 27 minutes past it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Supported by you, our listeners, listening for our sponsors and letting them know that you're listening and patronizing their products, particularly the sponsors on the local station that you're listening to, plus our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all organic, all fair trade, Small Dog Electronics, the latest iPod, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's another dimension of this. We're just talking about the question of, why do economies exist? And what should the relationship be between the economic powers in a nation and the nation itself, or the people of the nation? And I am speaking as somebody who has played the game of business for the better part of 30 years and done so sometimes rather successfully, other times not quite so much, but overall I've done fairly well and no complaints, shall we say. I'm of the opinion that my being given the right to have, for example, limited liability by creating a corporation, by my society, by my nation, is that there's an exchange for that. It's an exchange for that limited liability, an exchange for the ability to have to take advantage of certain tax laws, to be able to write off things that as an individual I couldn't, for example. In exchange for that, I have certain obligations. And I think we just need to nail these down and say, here are the obligations. And that as a society, we should collectively be saying, what are the industries that we want to protect in the United States that we really should have here? I mean, is it really in our best interest that we can't build a missile right now without parts from China? Is that a wise thing? Somehow I think not. Is it in our national interest that we have no national economic or industrial policy? And as a result, we have gone from becoming the world's largest. And when 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, as the result of 200 years of tariffs, protectionism, as a result of 200 years of rational economic policies that have been followed by every country in the world for thousands of years, We were the largest importer of raw materials in the world and the largest exporter of finished goods in the world. We, the United States, we were the ultimate first world country. 26 years later, we are now the largest importer of finished goods in the world and the largest exporter of raw materials. We used to import iron ore and turn it into steel and turn that into frames for TV sets and cars and things and then sell those overseas. We used to bring in raw materials and ship out finished goods. Now it's the other way around. Now we are shipping out iron ore. We are shipping out gold. We are shipping out all kinds of raw materials. We're shipping out lumber. We're actually a net exporter of trash, which the Chinese are using our trash paper and turning them into boxes that they then package the TVs that they sell us back to. We are the largest importer of finished goods in the world, the largest exporter of raw materials. We have become the definition of a banana republic, a third world country, because of these insane trade policies. And so we're trying to work this thing out with Korea, where they become as crazy as we are, and they're saying no! For example, this is from the article in the Wall Street Journal. Many Korean citizens view domestic rice production, and keep in mind, they have a 52% tariff on imported rice. Many Korean citizens view domestic rice production as a symbol of their country's ability to feed itself. It is! Yes, their consumers pay more for rice than people do in China, for example, but if China decides to cut off their rice supply, they don't have to worry because they still have a domestic rice industry. And people can still make a living growing rice in South Korea, and they say, you know, that's worth the trade-off for slightly higher prices. Yes, it's not as efficient as the Cato Institute would talk about, you know, their damning of protectionism and their embrace of laissez-faire and so-called corporate free trade or multinational free trade. Here's another example of it. This down in Texas. KKR, Goldberg Kravis Roberts, is a big, you know, private equity company. Fancy way of saying, you know, a bunch of very, very wealthy people who get together and basically buy companies, make a profit on them, buy and sell companies. They want to buy TXU. TXU is a generator of electricity in Texas. And Rebecca Smith in today's Wall Street Journal. Yesterday, a firm hired by state officials to monitor Texas's wholesale power market said it concluded that TXU took advantage of its dominant market position during the summer of 2005 to raise electricity prices in the power spot market by an average of 15.5%. In other words, because they were a monopoly, they were able to just say, you know, that's it. We're going to come in here and we're going to jack the prices up. And boy, am I hearing something strange coming through my headphones, Clay. I don't know what that is, but it sounds like the ocean. Anyway, they said, because we control the market, we're going to jack the prices up 15%. You're just going to have to pay more for power. As they write in the Wall Street Journal, it's the first time TXU has been found to have intentionally abused the deregulated market. Gee, you're right. How can you deregulate a market in which people have monopolies? Give me a break. The TXU says, we are obviously disappointed in the findings. Yeah. But you're keeping the $70 million, right? What are the fines for this? $25,000 per violation per day. Does that add up to $70 million? Somehow I doubt it. Their profits in 2006, profits, this is the money that's left over after they've delivered electricity to people and they've been paid. Their profit for 2006, TXU, this one company in Texas, this one power company, $2.55 billion. Now consider, if this was a not-for-profit corporation whose purpose was to deliver electricity to people in the state of Texas rather than to spin off profits for their stockholders, which is the prime purpose of every for-profit corporation. And, you know, and a fine thing it is, by the way, you know, speaking as somebody who has owned several, and right now I own a for-profit corporation, which is this program. And you know, that's fine. But if TXU, instead of being a for-profit corporation whose first job was to make money, if their first job was to deliver electricity and they were responsible to the citizens of the state, if they were a not-for-profit or publicly held utility, if they were owned by the citizens of the state, or if they were governed by a board of directors who didn't care whether they made a profit or not, but did care about whether or not they delivered electricity, there would have been an additional $2.5 billion the TXU could have used to, oh, let's say, put solar panels all over Texas and start diversifying their energy portfolio. I'm just telling you, this laissez-faire economic ideology, which has infected both parties so badly, has done incredible harm to this country in the last 26 years. And other countries around the world are not buying it. Across Central and South America, they're saying, we are leaving it behind. The South Koreans are saying, we're having no part of it. Bush wants Congress in 2006 to renew his so-called fast-track authority, his ability to shove a trade agreement down our throats, whether we want it or not, without amendment. And I sure hope the Democratic Party can marshal 40 votes in the Senate to block that so that it dies a natural death, because it should. In fact, today, somebody should drive a stake through its heart and kill it off. This is authority that was first asked for by Nixon. Nobody, Reagan was asking for. I think George Walker Bush, or Herbert Walker Bush, was the first guy to get it. I'd have to go back and look. But, I mean, this is laissez-faire run amok. What a surprise. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Ian, you are live and on the air.
Hi. Tom?
What's up? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this matter of business records in case of Halliburton.
Yeah.
What I remember from that DPW, the Dubai Ports World debate where they were going to take over our ports, the thing that was brought up there was that they could maintain their records in Dubai.
Right.
And the problem was then they would not be subject to U.S. courts.
Right, or oversight.
Well,
this is the thing. If you go with Friedmanism, if you go with this insane, you know, throw all the borders open, do away with all the laws, and let's just have the multinational corporations decide how the economics of the world should operate, then nobody is answerable to anybody, except maybe the World Trade Organization, which sets the rules only for the very largest players. It's like the conference board.
Now, you talk about corporations often, you know, they're defined to be like an individual, you know, the way they're dealt with. It seems to me that what we got here is we've got essentially a defendant, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Halliburton, in terms of what they've done to rip off this country. And if you had a defendant that was a flight risk, you'd tell them you can't leave. You
right.
Stay here until we work this out. They
pull a passport.
Ordered somehow to stay here. And you know what happened? 4 days before the election, this last November, Bechtel said they're no longer doing any contracts in Iraq. These
right.
guys knew the Democrats were going to win the House. They knew there were going to be subpoenas coming. What these people see, the subpoenas of the House, when Waxman goes after Halliburton, those subpoenas cannot be enforced by the Congress. They have to be enforced by our courts. And
right.
they're going to.
And if Halliburton
Dubai,
is a Dubai company, maybe they don't have to be enforced at all.
They're not going to be subject to it.
Yeah, yeah. This
That's
is,
what it's
see,
about.
This is. I don't disagree with you, Ian. This is the logical extreme of this general insanity that we're seeing, oddly enough, in these seemingly disparate stories about South Korea and trade and TXU in the Wall Street Journal today. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
On a mouth like this. One man he resists. One man washed on an empty beach. One man chained with a kiss. In the name of love. What a man.
Welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Terry in Ville Platte, Louisiana. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me so quickly.
Sure.
I wanted to first, I guess, kind of compliment you. You're one of the only people that I hear most of the time that will really attack the dangers of free and open trade.
Except it's not really free and open. It's very unfree and unopen to small and medium-sized businesses. It is free and open to big multinational corporations. Even the language of it is difficult.
Our family's kind of a victim of it. My father, all the Hoyt side of my family, we've been in the sugar business for a while. We live in kind of an area where you can grow a lot of different things, corn, soybeans. Then we went to sugar, whatever is best in the market, the best price you could kind of do.
Right.
And sugar got to be pretty good in the late 90s, so we shifted out of cotton as our main thing and back into sugar. And my father learned of the passing of CAFTA, and, you know, sooner or later Cuba will be, I think, included into that. But the price of sugar, the world market was, I think, around 2000, 2001, 7 cents a pound. The U.S. market was 21 cents a pound. And at 21 cents a pound, we were showing a loss. So I really think they want to even drive it down to 7 cents a pound, completely
sure.
Decimating that industry over here. So, I mean, we've been farming. My great-grandfather started in Cheneyville around 1905. And before that, we had been in the area since the 1840s, and it ended.
Right, so you've been doing business in this country for 150 years, just fine, thank you very much. And then they do away with these so-called trade barriers, and boom, your family business is destroyed. Is that the bottom line here,
Terry? Well, my dad decided to do it. Just, you know, it's better to bail out, because he had lost money 2 years in a row, better to bail out now than, you know, have the sheriff one day come and knock on our house.
And then go bankrupt. So you sold it off?
Yeah.
You sold off the farm.
Another industry is being hurt because of this. In Louisiana, the shrimp and the crawfish industry, I think 90% of the shrimp that we get in this country comes from, you know, I guess
it's coming from Asia.
China.
Yeah.
Vietnam and those areas.
Yep. Oh, yeah, Vietnam. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Terry, thank you for sharing your story with us. You're spot on, and I appreciate it. It's a good example. Alan, St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Alan.
How's it going?
What's up?
One thing about national security is if there would happen to be a bird flu epidemic, a severe bird flu in Asia, and we had to shut our borders down to Asian
toast,
to the Asian market.
Actually, we couldn't make toast because we don't make toasters in the United States.
Right? We don't have any manufacturing base. You know,
I know it's nuts. It is absolutely insane. And this Kool-Aid, I mean, Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush were both drinking it. And you had that crazy old coot with the big ears out there, Ross Perot, and he was right. I'm sorry, I didn't vote for him, but he was right. He was on that issue. Good point, Al. Thank you very much for making it, John in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Yes, I was just listening to comments about Cato, Milton Friedman, and the like. And though I'm not like saying that I feel one way or the other, the one thing that I have read into what that point of view is, and the one thing that I've noticed is that I just think that how you were presenting what they think, I think, is a little bit off, in that they feel that a lot of the things like heavy corporate power and all the things that make them power, that give them power, that bolster their power, are extensions of state power, and that if the state could not do as much as they can in putting their hands in these in their affairs, that things like the WTO would not exist, and that multinationals would not be able to exert as much power to get their way. And
right,
I think that's the one part of that point of view that I feel you're kind of jumping over and not really
right. But in that part of that point of view, they're wrong, because states authorize corporations to exist. States provide stable currencies for corporations. States provide a legal system by which corporations can do business. States provide court systems by which corporations can litigate and enforce contracts. I mean, you know, without the existence of states, you don't have the ability of corporations to operate.
And free market.
Well, you'd have true anarchy, actually.
Well,
or you'd have absolute oligarchy.
Yeah, I'm not to an extreme. Just you know, they say that that state power is, that corporate power is a reflection of state power, and that's where they have their focus.
I know, and they're wrong. I mean, they're still trying to fight the Cold War. They still think that you know, communism is viable, and they need to be freaked out about it. And yeah, good point, John. And they're wrong. They are absolutely wrong. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike. Mike, you gotta be listening to your telephone and not to the radio. Sorry about that. Jay in Playa del Rey, California. Hey, Jay.
Tom.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Jay Sedrish. I was calling it because you always make a comment. It's kind of about capitalism isn't a political system. It's an economic system.
Yes.
But I agree with your sentiment. I disagree with your syntax. The truth is that capitalism has become the political system of the United States of America. And I say that not only...
Unfortunately. Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you. It's also becoming the political system of China.
It is, to
some extent.
But what I'm saying is legally, we have imbued a sense of personhood and the legal rights
yes.
of personhood.
Oh, I know. I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, tracking all the way back to the 1886 Santa Clara County decision. And in fact, what I found was in that Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the court actually did not grant corporate personhood. They did not say that corporations are persons. But oddly enough, people have been saying that, including the Supreme Court 34 times since then, have been saying that the court did say that. It was the headnote of the decision. The decision itself actually contradicted that headnote. The headnote was written by the clerk of the court, who's, by the way, coincidentally, who used to be the former president of a railroad, John Davis, so I forget his last name. Anyhow, it's wrong. It's a wrong case. So 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, the naysayers are out there, and the naysayers on both sides. Today, a Wall Street Journal article. By the way, welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. New York Times article, excuse me. New York Times today going after Al Gore. Quoting a lot of the, or a number of the more prominent of the global climate change naysayers or cautioners or whatever. And there's this video from Channel 4 in the United Kingdom that's out now that I've gotten zillions of emails. Hey, you've got to go see this thing. It's incredible. And that lays out the suggestion that global climate change is actually caused by variations in solar activity. And in all probability, if you look over centuries or millennia or millions of years, geological time periods, all probability absolutely certain that solar activity has something to do with that. You know, obviously the things like, you know, being hit by meteorites doesn't help. But the consensus these days seems to be that, you know, it was true that probably, you know, the sun had to do with maybe 80% of climate change at the beginning of this century, but now it's flipped and now we're responsible for maybe 80% of climate change. But still, there's folks who are on the other side. Dennis Avery, for example, is with the Hudson Institute. He's a former State Department analyst and an expert on environmental and agricultural issues at the Hudson Institute. Hudson.org is his website. And, Dennis, you have a problem with Barbara Boxer's website, packforachange.com, and her Help Me Stop Global Warming, I think.
Well, I don't understand why we don't talk more about the climate change for which we have evidence. 1984, we brought up the first long ice core from Greenland. 250,000 years of the Earth's temperature history in the oxygen isotopes of the layers. They tell us the temperature of the air when the ice was laid down. And we had expected to find the big ice age cycle in that ice core, and we did. We had not expected to find a little natural, abrupt, moderate solar-linked cycle 1,500 years in its cycle length. Warmings every 1,500 years that lasted 5 to 8 centuries.
Right.
And which were so moderate and so long that they
seem to be linked to some variation in sunspot activity now.
Yes.
Looking back at
I
don't think anybody's disputing that. The point is used to be the major variable, and now, according to the Intergovernmental Commission on Climate Change, or Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, the largest variable is what we're doing.
If I give you 50% of the net warming since 1940, how much do you think that is?
Well, actually, from 1940 until 1970, there wasn't a whole substantial amount of warming. In fact, as I recall, there was a decrease.
From 1940 to today, you're talking 0.2 degrees Celsius.
But try it from 1900 to today.
You get 1/10.
What is it from 1900 to today?
From 1850, when it started, until 1940, is about 0.5.
Okay, and from 1970 to today, what is it?
Well, no, you don't get that.
See, that's the thing. That 1940 to 1970 is what you're trying to pull out of it.
I know what you're trying to do with these statistics here. If you're going to pull out 19...
There was a leveling there between 1940 and 1970.
There was a decline.
Yeah, you're right.
There was an actual decline in
worldwide temperature.
And that seems to be associated
with solar variation.
If you're going to pull out 76 to 98, I'm going to pull out 1916 to 1940, which is almost identical in length.
And I want to point out
to your listeners that nothing in climate goes in a straight line. Ever.
Of course. And if you're going to select your few years and I'm going to select my few years, I guess we can both be demonstrating the old axiom that figures never lie, but liars can figure.
Well, if this were a human CO2 warming, it should have started about 1940 and soared strongly upward with the post-war industrial boom.
Assuming that there were no other variables, but obviously there is a solar variable that's affecting it. Obviously there is the sinking effect of the ocean.
I'm pleased that you're willing to talk about the solar variable now, because for the last 20 years nobody has.
But I think it's been conventional wisdom. I mean, that was the assumption before people were looking at carbon dioxide.
Does Al Gore ever mention a 1500-year cycle? I saw the movie. I don't recall that.
Well, I stood next to him when he did a presentation here in Portland, and I recall him pointing out if you're talking about the Little Ice Age or the period that wasn't 1500. Well, that might have been the tail end of a 1500-year cycle.
It certainly looks like it.
Yeah. Well, he points it out. It's on his graph then.
And in 2001, the last IPCC report showed a graph with 900 years of no change in our temperature and then an upswoop in the 20th century. That graph came to be known as the hockey stick, and it now turns out to be a scientific lie.
Well, and this is one of there the are reasons. Folks on the other side who would say, no, the hockey stick is just fine, thank you very much. It's just that you guys are mischaracterizing it as a hockey stick.
Wait a minute. I've got to halt you there because I have some personal knowledge on this basis. The most heavily weighted evidence in that graph and that study were a set of tree rings from bristlecone pines in the Sierra Nevada of California. Very old trees. They live 4,000 or 5,000 years. And they had a growth spurt in the 20th century, which the hockey stick study laid to temperature increase. But as the study which derived the growth rings said in its abstract, there had been no temperature increase in the Sierra Nevada to have caused this growth spurt. The study was about the CO2 fertilization effect on mature trees.
And the fact is that as you increase temperature, you increase CO2, and vice versa.
That's an unproven linkage.
Well, actually, according to the climate skeptics, I mean, your own movie out there about global hysteria that Channel 4 is broadcasting, their whole point was you warm up the oceans, you increase the rate at which they expel carbon dioxide.
Yeah, but
they're saying that it's the other way around, that CO2 is increasing because the temperatures are going up and it's all being driven by the sun. And Al Gore's side, and I would say my side, is saying, there's some small element of that, but also as CO2 goes up, it raises up temperature. I mean, here's the bottom line, Dennis Avery with the Hudson Institute, Hudson.org. If you guys are right and it's all about solar variation, there's nothing we can do about it, you know, maybe we should just kind of go back to, you know, no big deal. Although I think, frankly, we should be very concerned about the fact that one in three of us are getting cancer in our lifetimes, and there's a huge association between that and the use of fossil fuels and all the carcinogenic byproducts of that.
But
let me just finish my sentence here.
Of the worst sort.
Well, no, that's the reality. One in three Americans will get cancer in their lifetime.
There's been no linkage drawn between fossil fuels and cancer. There's a linkage between wait a minute,
you ever heard of benzene?
Cancer.
Yeah, all right. Well, in any case, the point is, if you guys are wrong, then we've got our children and grandchildren are going to deal with a disaster. Shouldn't we err on the side of caution?
What's the price tag? What's the premium on your insurance policy? I think it's giving up 90% of the energy I use.
It would be creating a dot-com boom. It would be creating using all. I mean, look at the enormous amount of solar power that's falling on the United States. Look at all the wind power we have. There are so many alternatives out there.
My neighbor just spent $100,000 to build a windmill to free himself from his electric bill. $100,000 to get rid of his electric bill?
Yeah, this is the insanity of having the electric industry and the power industry locked into fossil fuels and nuclear for the last 40, 50 years, in large part because of subsidies and government regulation that has made it more and more difficult to do alternative energy. Look at all the alternative energy that came along when Jimmy Carter decided to change policies.
California showed us how to solve that problem with rolling blackouts.
No, I was saying, again, you're big power companies and their monopolies. Enron brought us the rolling blackouts, Dennis.
You're a your dream.
Yeah.
They hadn't built any power plants, and they were using more electricity.
Hudson.org is the website. Dennis Avery, the analyst, and packforachange.com is the other product. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6:23, 2070. Back 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Yeah, Barbara Boxer's all over this on global warming, and I think this is fascinating. She's reaching out to her constituents and saying, you know, well, actually to everybody in the country, presumably, and saying, what do you think? How would you stop global warming? Today, she writes, the battle in the Senate to reduce global warming begins, and I want you to be part of it. This is the time I want to hear from you before we sit down and write the legislation we believe will become law this year. This is at Barbara Boxer's PAC4A Change.com, P-A-C, as in Political Action Committee, PAC4A Change.com. And it's right there on the homepage. And you know, what do you want? Do you want increased fuel economy? Do you want more incentives for alternative fuel vehicles? You have government investment and development of renewable energy sources? Gee, what a novel idea. After giving $10 billion to the oil companies and the gas companies, the coal industry last year, after subsidizing the nuclear industry since 1954, the passage of Price-Anderson, I believe it was 54, it might have been 57, whenever it was, whenever Price Anderson was passed, that nuclear power would be so expensive it would be mind-bogglingly unaffordable if the nuclear power industry had to buy insurance. So we, the people, will provide them with insurance. Now, if you believe, as many people believed in the 1950s, that nuclear power was going to provide us with free electricity, and it was a good and safe technology and a wonderful thing. I mean, we bought the propaganda. We believed it. A lot of, I'd say probably the majority of Americans believed it. My best friend, I remember in the 60s when I was in the late 50s when I was in elementary school, my best friend's dad converted his house. This was in Lansing, Michigan, converted his house from oil, from an oil furnace to all electric. This must have been about 1959. I was around 8 years old. He converted his house to all electric because he knew that when they built a nuclear power plant near Lansing, that the electricity would be free. And he saw free electricity coming, so, hey, let's turn the house electric. They used to give away free light bulbs. I remember, you know, we'd get in the car, my three brothers and I with my dad and mom, and drive down to every couple of months, 6 months, every year, there, whatever it was, drive down to the local utility and trade in our burned-out light bulbs for free replacement light bulbs. Free electricity is coming. Nuclear power. And so they passed this, you know, it's uninsurable because we don't know what the risks are. Well, it makes sense if it's something you really want, something that's actually essential to business, and you don't know what the risks are, it does make sense that the public would take on a good chunk of the risk. But now, here, 40 years later, we have a pretty good sense of what the risk is, and I'd argue that we don't need Price Anderson anymore. But we're still subsidizing the nuclear power industry, hugely. So Barbara Boxer says, should we instead offer, well, she doesn't even say should we instead, should we offer incentives for deployment of energy-efficient devices in homes or development of renewable energy sources? Should we give green grants to cities and counties for energy efficiency projects and buildings and auto fleets, as well as greatly increasing the planting of carbon-absorbing trees? Should we require all federal office buildings, there's 8,000 of them, to become green buildings? Should we make the 60,000-vehicle federal government auto fleet a model of energy efficiency? Should we implement a cap-and-trade carbon emission system? Should we reduce power plant emissions? You can go over and you can vote. PactForAChange.com. How would you stop global warming? She asks. In the midst of this, Seth Borenstein, the Associated Press's science writer, in the AP today. From Saturday. This weekend's news. The harmful effects of global warming on daily life are already showing up, and within a couple of decades, hundreds of millions of people won't have enough water, top scientists will say next month at a meeting in Belgium. At the same time, tens of millions of others will be flooded out of their homes each year as the earth reels from rising temperatures and sea levels, according to portions of a draft of an international scientific report obtained by the Associated Press. This is the new IPCC report that's coming down the road. It hasn't been released yet. This is the second of a series of four that are coming out this year. And it's going to be brutal. It's going to be absolutely brutal. And so the fossil fuel industry and the naysayers are gearing up big time. I mean, they are cranking this thing up as fast as they can. Oh, there's nothing to worry about. Oh, it's only solar variations. Got nothing to do with the oil companies. Got nothing to do with fossil fuels. Got nothing to do with carbon dioxide. Yeah, carbon dioxide's gone from 300 parts per million to 400 and pushing 500 million. It doesn't matter, though. You know, don't worry. Be happy. Buy more gasoline. At what point do we say, wait a minute? You know, I know this is making Dick Cheney and his buddies a pile of money and George Bush and his old oil buddies a pile of money and Condi Rice, who had an oil tanker named after her when she was on the board of directors of Chevron, a pile of money. I know it's making all of them a pile of money and certainly our good friends, the Saudis. But maybe we should even talk about community energy independence. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
lady better call.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Well, it's becoming increasingly obvious that Alberto Gonzalez lied under oath when he said that all Bush-appointed attorneys would be Senate-confirmed. Back on January 18th, he was speaking before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which at that time was chaired by Arlen Specter, as I recall. I think this would have been before, the new Senate. Or was it after? Maybe it was Pat Leahy. I'd have to go back and look at the January timeline and see when the Senate officially flipped. But in any case, Gonzalez is testifying. And he says, so let me publicly sort of preempt perhaps a question you're going to ask me, and that is, I am fully committed, as the administration's fully committed, to ensure that with respect to every United States attorney position in this country, we will have a presidentially appointed, Senate-confirmed United States attorney. End of quote. But 6 weeks earlier, Kyle Sampson, the guy who just resigned, his chief of staff. Why does the chiefs of staff keep falling by the wayside? Scooter Libby, he's Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Now we've got Kyle Sampson, who is Alberto Gonzalez's chief of staff. Why are they falling by the wayside? Maybe because they're fall guys. Anyhow, he sends an email. He says, there's some risk that we'll lose the authority, but if we don't ever exercise it, what's the point of having it? Right? In other words, this Justice Department, we don't need to get Senate confirmation for these guys. We're not going to have to get Senate. We can go ahead and do it. We can do political action. Chuck Schumer, just now, speaking out on this, and speaking out rather forcibly, I'd say.
This weekend, I called for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to step down. Today's staff resignation does not take heat, Attorney General. In fact, it raises the temperature. Kyle Sampson will not become the next Scooter Libby, the next fall guy. Either Attorney General Gonzalez knew what his chief of staff was doing, that's a pretty severe indictment, or he didn't, which means he doesn't have the foggiest idea of what's going on in the Justice Department.
So, let's see. Either he's a criminal or he's incompetent. Which is it? Well, actually, there's some evidence coming out that him and Bush were conspiring. Bush, yes, George W. Bush, yes, the President of the United States, were conspiring to make this happen.
We now have direct evidence that Attorney General Gonzalez was carrying out the political wishes of the President in at least some of these firings.
In other words, he wasn't incompetent. In other words, Gonzalez did lie to the Senate and is a crook.
A startling amount of information about the White House's role has emerged in the past few days. Attorney General Gonzalez, chief of staff, withheld information on the White House's role in the Justice Department in terms of who was preparing to testify to Congress. Attorney Gonzalez's chief of staff may well have obstructed justice.
So I say to the senator, the good senator, where's the special prosecutor? Let's have it investigated. And actually, I expect that they're going to have one. There is going to be some serious investigation of this thing. And we'll see how long Gonzalez.
Political operatives and elected officials in New Mexico complained about one U.S. attorney's failure to indict Democrats quickly enough. Those complaints were passed on to Karl Rove and to the president himself. The president weighed in with Attorney General Gonzalez, and within weeks, that U.S. attorney, David Iglesias, was fired.
Interesting, yes.
Indeed, today's reports make clear that Mr. Iglesias was not on the hit list until October, just when he was staving off inappropriate pressure tactics.
That would be from Heather Wilson and Pete Domenici, by the way.
So if he wasn't on the list when the list was made up, and then you get the phone calls from the White House and from legislators, and then he's added to the list, what conclusion other than political interference can one come to?
And here's why this is so dangerous, is because the founders had this very clear idea that there should be three branches of government and they should be co-equal but separate. The first among the equals would be the legislative branch, because that's the closest to the people. It's directly elected by the people. The second among equals would be the executive branch, the president, because the president is at least indirectly elected by the people through the Electoral College. And the third among equals would be the judiciary, which is not at all elected by the people, is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So, you know, very indirect. And there must be barriers between these three in terms of interference. And so at the top of Drudge Report today, I mean, this is the right-wing spin on this thing. You look at the right-wing spin is absolutely mind-boggling. Right? The federal prosecutors are appointed when a new administration comes in. Every 4 years or every 8 years. And they know. They've got a job for 4 years. And maybe for 8 years if the president, you know, gets reelected. They know that. But they also know that during those 4 years, their job is to prosecute wrongdoing, even if it happens to be a Republican like Duke Cunningham. They're not there to be political instruments. They're the judiciary, even though they're appointed by the president. So over at the top of Drudge, Chief of Staff of U.S. Attorney General quits. Okay, this is Gonzalez's number two guy, quits. Second headline, Bush White House mulled firing all prosecutors. Yeah, apparently they were thinking about firing all of them and finding political. And then they thought, we can't find 93 or 97 political hacks that easily and that fast. So let's just fire the ones that, you know, are clearly not doing what we want. And there may be actually some who are doing what we want, because there's now evidence coming out that some of these federal prosecutors were actually engaging in political prosecutions. But then the Drudge Report, the third headline, flashback, Clinton White House fired all prosecutors. Well, yeah, and so did George Herbert Walker Bush, and so did Ronald Reagan, and so did Jimmy Carter, and so did Richard Nixon, and so did Jerry Ford. This is at the beginning of each term. These are political appointees. But they're not appointed in the this is the judiciary. They're not appointed like, I'm going to appoint you so that you'll do what I want. There can be a certain amount of, I'm going to appoint you because I like the way you think. But once you're appointed as a prosecutor, it's hands off. But no, that's not how the right wing wants to spin it. The right wing wants to spin it in a whole different direction. A lot on the table today. A lot going on today. Free trade insanity. Air America offering to match Fox, essentially, and say, yeah, we'll co-host or host, especially the Republican Party. We'll host some presidential primary debates if you want. Seems like a reasonable plan. I mean, we're both all about opinion, Fox News and Air America, right? Pretty straightforward. We have global warming. The naysayers are Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody is free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometimes. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Friends, 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Phillips with us, Project Censored, Sonoma State University's. You guys have turned this thing from what I'm guessing was just a small idea into a huge thing.
It's really grown, yeah. 1.5 million hits on our website in the first 2 weeks of October.
This is when the new one came out?
Yeah. It's just, we get a couple million a month anyway, but.
Yeah. ProjectCensored.org, the website we're talking about.
Exactly, and. When Carl founded it, I mean, this is our 29th year of doing this.
Oh, really? So, I had no idea it was that long.
It's been, Carl Jensen did it for 20 years, and then I've been director for the past nine.
That's great. Well, I'm honored to be part of it, to have won one of your awards and to be in one of your books. And although it's been a couple of years, I'll have to do it again. I'm going to have to get back to writing more and, I guess, talking less. Some of the top stories that were censored in 2005 that are out in your... You say censored 2006, this is 2005. These are really the top stories that were censored in 2004.
As of March and April last year. So
yeah.
That's when we had to shut it off, and then we write the book, and it comes out in the spring. I mean, it comes out in the fall. But if we call it 2005, everybody's going to think it's old news by the time it gets in the bookshelf.
Yeah,
so we call it 2006 like almanacs.
Right, yeah.
And
which makes sense in the publishing world.
Yeah, it does.
But these are really the most underreported or unreported stories in 2004. Numbers 8 and 9, Iraqi farmers threatened by Bremer's mandate, and Iran's new oil system challenges U.S. currency. There's a bit of a thread, I suppose, between the two. Well, let's just take them one at a time. Iraqi farmers threatened by Bremer's mandates. I don't think most Americans know what Bremer's mandates were.
Well, they went in and he issued 100 different directives that were very pro-corporation, very pro-U.S. privatizing the economy of Iraq.
They were trying to create a libertarian paradise.
Something to that effect.
Yeah.
Let
me just toss this out at you, Peter, and see what you think of it. My take on what they were trying to do in Iraq was they said, you know, those nasty liberals, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, when they rebuilt Europe and Japan, they gave them strong labor unions and universal health care and all the things that they couldn't get here in the United States because the Republicans started blocking them after they took the House and Senate in the election of 46. And so they did that in Europe and Japan to try and prove that they were right. And we're gonna go into Iraq and we're gonna remake Iraq as a conservative paradise and prove that it'll be even more successful than Europe was. And they did, and it's not.
And it's not.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, $100 million went to re-educate, that's in quotes, Iraqi farmers to do more industrial-sized harvests so they can export more products. And they're getting them to buy genetically engineered seeds from Monsanto and other corporations so that they have to permanently buy those seeds. And so we've put the GMO issue right into Iraq. They didn't have it before. And now they're growing crops, and we're marketing those crops for them for the international market. Instead of the subsistence market and feeding people there, we're building the stuff for export. And this was mandated. This was imposed upon the Iraqi farmers by Bremer.
And is there not a provision in either the Hague Conventions or somewhere in the UN Conventions or the Geneva Conventions that says that if you take a country in war, if you defeat a country in war, you occupy a country in war, that you cannot change their constitution until they have their own government? In other words, only their own government can change their constitution. And yet that's what Bremer did.
He completely went in. They rewrote what was going on, and they basically set up and told the puppet government in Iraq today how they wanted to see that constitution laid out.
Right. Yeah.
And they federalized it and broken the country up into three segments, two with oil, one without. And so they've and that's part of what the resistance is about today. I mean,
sure.
People just simply aren't going to tolerate that.
Yeah, in part it's religion, in large part it's economics, and that's the huge part of the untold story. Now, just before Bush invaded Iraq, Saddam Hussein was talking about denominating his oil in euros.
He didn't.
He did it. Okay.
He did. He was selling oil in euros, and that was the first thing Bremer did when he got back there.
He flipped it to dollars.
Back to that dollars.
Now the Iranians are talking about creating an oil bourse, a trading floor that will denominate oil in euros.
Exactly.
And we're now talking about invading Iran. Do you see? Does A equal B here?
That's one of our top stories this year, and people don't know that. I mean, the U.S. the dollar is used as the oil mark in the oil market worldwide. So Japan has to buy oil in dollars. China buys oil in dollars. I mean, they need the dollars to buy the oil. If that's
therefore we can run at a deficit.
Exactly.
If that switched, we
would see massive inflation in the U.S.
Right.
And so that's something they're really trying to block and militarily enforce.
Right, because our currency would no longer be needed by the world, so people would all over the world would no longer be buying our debt
and
taking our IOUs.
And China's one of the biggest. But Chavez in Venezuela is trading oil for doctors to Cuba and making other agreements in Latin America to sell oil. He's selling oil to the Chinese directly,
yeah.
And it's in dollars right now, but it could easily not be.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I mean, if Chavez says, okay, it's not going to be in dollars anymore, the day later, is Chavez still in power?
Maybe a day or two.
but I mean, you know, here seems to be this kind of
pattern.
You know,
yes.
Oil-rich countries say
we've already tried to take them out once, so we'll see.
Now, didn't the Saudis about 3 or 4 years ago talk about trading in gold riyads instead of dollars, and that like went away really fast? That got floated.
The Saudis are totally dependent on the U.S. for protection.
Yeah.
I mean, they're running a kingdom there, repressing a whole lot of people inside of Saudi Arabia and are incredibly rich in the process. So they're very dependent upon U.S. Support.
Yeah, so they're not going to rock
the boat. They're not going to rock the boat.
They're not. Okay. Interesting. I remember the whole story of the gold riyad coming out. Dr. Peter Phillips manages Sonoma State University's student-run media research group, Project Censor, the website projectcensor.org. Dr. Phillips, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
So much to have you. So nice to have you here in the studio. Good luck on this. It's a great book, a wonderful project. The book is out, Censored 2006. You can check it out. You can buy it. Bookstores all over the country. Projectcensor.org, the website. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks so much for being with us today, my friends. We will see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes. But for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music.
Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. We're back live here on Tuesday, March 13th at, 2 p.m., 2.06 p.m. Eastern Time, 11.06 a.m. Pacific Time, and all places in between. For those of you who are listening to the last segment of the last hour, we had a bit of a technical problem, but we're back and functional, so all is well. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Naomi Klein is with us. She writes for The Nation, among other things. She has a new book, actually, coming out in September called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism from Metropolitan Books. Naomi Klein, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And by the way, the website for The Nation is thenation.com, for whom you also write. You have recently written about the cruel methods U.S. interrogators have been using since 9/11 and how it's a remarkable thing that these are finally being put on trial in a Miami courtroom.
That's right. I wrote about the Jose Padilla case. There were hearings about whether he was fit to stand trial, which really did put there was a potential for putting on trial all of the methods that were used to break him, really. And it was an extraordinary case simply because these methods have been used on hundreds, possibly thousands, or definitely thousands, actually, of detainees, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo. But because they're used on foreigners, non-U.S. citizens, we don't hear anything but sort of snippets about those methods. The methods themselves are never put on trial. But because Jose Padilla was first classified as an enemy combatant, and then the Bush administration changed its mind when it looked like the Supreme Court would say they didn't have the right to do that to a U.S. citizen because he's a U.S. citizen, he was brought to a regular civilian court, and that's what makes the case extraordinary.
Yeah, I understand that there was a series of experiments about some of these techniques, and we're not talking about, you know, violent physical punishment. You know, this isn't the Star Chamber. We're talking about things like prolonged isolation, alternating hot and cold, sensory deprivation, stress positions, and being confronted with the thing you are most terrified of, you know, dogs, for example, and that when these were experimented with back in the 50s or 60s or maybe it was the 70s, that they found that within a day or two, you not only would get information from people, A, B, the information could be completely unreliable. People would say whatever they thought you wanted to say. And C, that after 24 to 48 hours of this, you were beginning to inflict real and lasting psychological damage on people.
That's exactly right. And the experiments were performed in the 50s, the sensory deprivation experiments. And they were then codified in a CIA manual, the Kubark manual for interrogating so-called resistant sources. That manual was only declassified in the late 90s. Gosh, I'm so sorry. Sorry.
It's okay. No problem.
I should have turned off my cell phone as usual.
That's all right.
That we only saw the results of these experiments really codified in the late 90s, and when that manual was declassified, they refer to the so-called McGill experiments, and those are the experiments that you just mentioned, where students were taken and put in extreme sensory deprivation, just like what Jose Padilla faced, just like what we've seen images of from Guantanamo, the goggles, the headphones, and yeah, they started hallucinating after just 2 days.
Yeah, and gee, it's almost like Joseph Mengele all over again. In fact, you wonder, you know, in the early late 40s and early 50s, the CIA was aggressively recruiting from some of the Nazi sources. You know, it's you know, where did this stuff come from? Although I suppose, you know, it goes way back long before that.
Well, I mean, the issue, it's very similar because the argument that was used by the CIA at the time when they started doing this research under the MKUltra program was that they needed to understand the tactics that the communists were using to break U.S. soldiers in Korea. And the idea, the cover story, if you will, was we need to know our enemy so that we can prepare our soldiers. But, of course, there was another story, which is they wanted to understand these interrogation techniques for their own uses.
So what has happened with the process of putting on trial these techniques that have apparently destroyed Jose Padilla? He's been evaluated by several psychiatrists who one of them described him as a piece of furniture, basically.
Yes, what's happened so far is disappointing. The Miami court ruled that he's fit to stand trial. The judge Marcia Cook, she did not rule that she is withholding judgment on whether or not he was tortured faced such extraordinary, outrageous treatment that the case should be thrown out. She separated those two things. So the first was, is he competent to stand trial, which she defined very, very narrowly as, does he understand the charges against him? Does he understand what's going on in the courtroom? Which is really not the issue that the defense lawyers were arguing. They were arguing that they could not properly defend Jose Padilla because he was refusing to give them information about his interrogations.
Right. He was so far gone. He was so damaged by the interrogation process itself that he was convinced that his defense attorneys were part of the ongoing interrogation process, that this was just one more trick that
exactly.
was being set up.
Exactly. And what's unclear is whether he believed that because he was told that. And the reason why that is particularly relevant is because in an absolutely extraordinary twist in this case, it turns out that the tape of the last interrogation, they videotaped many of the interrogation sessions with Padilla, the court ordered that the government had to hand over all of those tapes to the defense, and they handed over many of the tapes, but not the last session. And they are now claiming, the government is now claiming that they lost the tape, which is just extraordinary. And in fact, Judge Cook had something of an outburst saying how unbelievable this was. And of course, one of the things that may have happened in that interrogation session, is that they may even have suggested, you know, they didn't want him to have a lawyer. The idea was never for Padilla to face this kind of a trial. The right. Supreme Court really pushed the administration's hand, and definitely the people who interrogated Padilla were worried about what he would say now that this was all going to be exposed in open court. So
maybe they did a phony trial for him with phony defense lawyers, and when he realized he was being tricked or
the symptom, the main symptom of these interrogation techniques, and it says it in the CIA manual that I mentioned earlier, the Kubark manual. It begins by saying that the goal of all of these techniques, sensory deprivation, stress positions, what they call capture shock, is to induce regression. Now, to basically transform an independent adult into a dependent child who then sees the interrogators as what they call a father-type figure. So that's very consistent with Padilla's behavior. He has not only expressed that he believes that his lawyers are part of the interrogation, but he has worried to his lawyers that the whole trial is unfair to the people who have been holding him, and he's worried that it's going to be too hard on them. In other words, he's protective of his captors, which is definitely a symptom of regression.
Yeah, so he has been broken. And apparently hundreds, maybe thousands of human beings around the world are being broken, probably as we speak, by our government using these techniques.
Well, the point is that that's the goal of these techniques. I mean, when you have these manuals that talk about inducing regression, the point is that people who are independent and able to act in their own self-interest don't give the theory is they don't give the information to the interrogators that they want. And so the goal is to unmake people so that they're not in control of their behavior. And the going insane is sort of a side effect, if you will, and it's sort of over regression. And this
Naomi, we only have a few seconds left. Is there anything that can be done to stop this, or is there anything that is being done to stop this? It seems like the politicians are afraid to take it on for fear of sounding like they're weak on terror.
I think there is. I think the main thing at this point is to reject this idea that psychological torture is somehow not torture. I think that there's been a real degradation of the discourse where we've accepted the idea that this is acceptable. And I think politicians need to get the message that it absolutely isn't, that it is torture, that doctors and lawyers consider it torture, and so do we.
Yeah. We need to be having this conversation more often and out loud in more venues. Naomi Klein, her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She writes at thenation.com. Naomi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Well, we're going to get there. We're definitely going to get there. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Just wanted to check in with you, Victoria. What's happening? Is it true that what I'm hearing, that it's actually a possibility that Gonzalez may resign, or is that just...
Well, he's certainly showing no signs of it even as we speak. He said that he's accountable. He's the CEO, and he's accountable, but basically his accountability stops with him saying that he's accountable. He shows no signs whatsoever of resigning. This man is not going to resign. He's also, you'll be glad to hear this, Tom, just said that he works for the American people, so that should be a big comfort to you.
Oh, yeah. I am enormously comforted. I don't think that anybody, if we were making a list 3 months ago of the things that George W. Bush might end up getting impeached for, this would not have been on the list, the firing of federal prosecutors for political purposes in order to reward some prosecutors for aggressively prosecuting Democrats and punish others for failing to aggressively prosecute Democrats. But now with these revelations that Gonzalez did some of these firings after George Bush called him and put pressure on him, you've got Chuck Schumer out there calling for Gonzalez's resignation. How long is it going to be before senators start calling for the president to speak out and explain himself on this?
I don't think it'll be very long. I mean, and we've got hearings starting. I think the drumbeat's going to be a little bit slow. It's moving up the food chain. It's going to move to Gonzalez. There's going to be calls for him. He's explaining himself now, and those explanations are not going to satisfy the Democrats one bit.
Yeah. How and in what venue is he explaining himself now?
It looks to me like he's standing in the Justice Department. I think he may be standing in front of that statue, but I can't tell because there's
he's holding a press conference?
He's holding a press conference right now.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, but I don't see any semi-naked statues, so I can't tell.
Okay.
Did he bring the statue back after Ashcroft or not? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Ashcroft didn't get rid of it. I think it's bolted to the floor. It's really heavy. He put a blue curtain
over it. I don't know if the curtain's come off. I don't know just how liberal this man is.
Yeah. I think the curtain's gone. I think it left with Ashcroft. But fascinating. What else is happening in Washington, D.C. right now?
Well, Speaker Pelosi also held a press conference this morning in which she spoke about the agenda of the Democrats, and other Democrats spoke as well, including your friend Henry Waxman. They spoke about what they're moving forward on now, including things like the Freedom of Information Act, Whistleblower Act, the Presidential Records Act. All things that have to do either with privacy or with making sure that more information gets out to the American people. Those are just three of the acts. I've forgotten the other three.
Privacy or transparency in government. Good stuff.
Exactly.
Good stuff. Any motion forward at all on pursuing what the cover-up was that Scooter Libby was trying to cover, you know, what it was that Scooter Libby was trying to cover up, which in my opinion is that the Niger documents that made their way into the State of the Union address, that Bush knew that these were forgeries because they were personally handed to him by Berlusconi back in 2001.
Scooter Libby's been taken over by events.
I see. And he's so,
old news. We're not capable of juggling more than two stories at a time.
I see. But yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. But I'm guessing that he got the phone call from George saying, "Don't worry, just hang on," and now Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, has apparently herded cats here with the Democrats in getting the Iraq funding resolution, this emergency resolution. Bush wants to do it this way so that it doesn't show up being part of his budget deficit, but. They've taken out of it the demand that Bush not attack Iran.
Right. Basically, the provision whereby Bush had to seek provision if he was going to attack Iran has come out. And this is partly because it would upset Israel.
Interesting. I thought it was because it would upset the Senate. But maybe it's because it would upset the Senate because it would upset Israel. Is that you think?
Well, that's the news report that I read.
Interesting. Is it going to be offered as a separate piece of legislation?
At this point, I can't tell. It's too soon to tell. I was at yet another press conference with Steny Hoyer this morning, and some questions about this were put to him, but that did not come up.
Hmm. Interesting. And also in this continuing resolution, or this Iraq funding resolution that's the Democrats have decided in the House that they're going to go ahead with, they're calling for a series of benchmarks, and that's a fine thing. But none of them are binding. None of them have, if this happens, then that happens. They simply call for them. And they call for withdrawal of the troops, or the beginning of the withdrawal of the troops, by August of 2008, with a goal of the end of 2008, just in time for Bush to have ended his presidency and say, okay, everybody's home and I'm declaring victory, and take credit, apparently, for ending the war. Is this going to be sped up? Does it really take 14 months, a year and a half to end a war?
I would be surprised if it's sped up very much, to be honest with you.
Yeah. It's almost as if the Republicans wrote this legislation in order to make the Bush presidency look good. I'm boggled by it.
That's
Victoria Jones. Yeah, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria. We'll be back with your calls in just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare say, no, not a chance! Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. This is entertaining. The Libyan news agency, JANA, the official news agency of Libya, has announced that we... Now keep in mind, this is Muammar Gaddafi, the guy who blew up Pan Am flight, whatever it was, over 108, I think it was, or 107, over Lockerbie, Scotland. The guy who runs his country is an iron-fisted dictator. But he happens to have a lot of oil. But, you know, here's another dictator. According to the official news agency of Libya, we are going to help them build a nuclear power plant. Something that we, right now, are complaining that Iran, a democracy with an elected president, is also doing. I wouldn't call Iran a full democracy, because the Ayatollahs have the Supreme Court power, basically, to determine whether something is sure is Islamic law or not. But nonetheless, Ahmadinejad was elected. Gaddafi, no, not a chance. I guess it's kind of measuring the lessers of evils, but Gaddafi, he's a good friend of the oil companies. Been a good friend of the oil companies. So now he's going to become a good friend of the nuclear industry. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in L.A., Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, bear with me. My brain's sleeping after being on hold for so long.
Sorry about that, Mike.
The corporate talk about corporate responsibility makes me think about all the irresponsibility and injustice that we see in the world today, and I can't help but wonder if it might be a good thing if we did our part to change or rescind some of the corporate limited responsibility law. Or you call limited liability, limited responsibility of these corporations, so that they don't get away with so much.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. There were a series of constraints on corporate power in the United States that were put into place by the founders and framers of this country and the framers of the Constitution and the various state constitutions that lasted right up until the era of the 1880s and 1890s, which is referred to as the charter-mongering era. And what had happened at that point in time was that John Rockefeller became so powerful that he was based out of Ohio. They had the oil fields in the Midwest at that time, which are all now dry, and he was creating these trusts and colluding with the railroads to refuse to carry oil for people who competed with him, and doing all kind, engaging in all sorts of illegal business practices that were illegal at the state level, state laws governing these, because corporations are chartered at the state level, not the federal level. The U.S. Constitution does not mention the word corporation. And so the state of Ohio went to him and they said, what you're doing is illegal. It's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed in 1881, and it's a violation of a whole series of Ohio laws. And so instead of doing what was right, what he said was, and by the way, it was illegal in every other state in the Union, he says, okay, what state will take me? What state will change their laws to take me? And so New York State said, well, we'll change our laws. And then New Jersey said, well, we'll change our laws. And then Delaware said, well, we'll change our laws. And then Connecticut said, well, we'll change our laws. And there was this competition among the states to dumb down their state constitutions or their state laws. Because prior to that time, a corporation could only exist for one single purpose. It could only do one thing. You couldn't have these conglomerates. A corporation could only live for the functional working lifespan of a person. It varied from state to state, ran from anywhere from 20 years to 40 years, and then at the end of that had to be dissolved. There was the equivalent of an inheritance tax, and then you'd redistribute the stock and start over, essentially, even though you could continue in operation, you know, with a brand and things. Patents and trademarks and things obviously didn't last anywhere near as long as they do now. I don't remember what the exact time was back then. And the first purpose for a corporation being incorporated back then, under the laws of virtually every state in the Union, had to be that its goal was to serve the public interest. And the attorneys general of every state, or the secretaries of state of every state, every year had to examine every corporation in the state, and lots of corporations got the corporate death penalty because they weren't acting in the state interests. Oh, and there was also, in most states, it was illegal for a corporation to own stock in another corporation. And so, you know, when Rockefeller did this and we went into the charter mongering era, all these states changed their laws, and that's why Delaware was the most liberal of all of them, which is why more than half of all the companies on the New York Stock Exchange, trade of the New York Stock Exchange, are Delaware corporations. Because in Delaware, you can start a corporation for any reason, and you can have a single officer, and, you know, there's virtually no limitations. And I think that we should consider going back to the way it was, you know, prior to that charter mongering era.
But Tom, you mentioned how we got to where we are because the states all jumped onto their separate bandwagons and let the corporations run loose. But why can't the country make a law to prevent this kind of unrestrained power?
The country can. The country can. I mean, we still have the Sherman Act on the books, and what, you know, a lot of what is going on right now is arguably illegal. The best, however, it's not being enforced. Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, which is why all of a sudden in the early 1980s we saw all these mergers and acquisitions. In fact, becoming an M&A guy, you know, mergers and acquisitions guy, became a brand new profession because it had been illegal for 200 years up until that point. And Michael Milken and all these guys, I mean, the last guy to actually enforce the Sherman Act was Jimmy Carter, busting up AT&T. But it's still there. He just basically stopped enforcing it and nobody started. The best suggestion I've heard on this so far is from Bernie Sanders, who suggested that, see, the problem, Mike, that states face is what you had when, for example, Boeing decided that they were going to leave Seattle, they were going to move their headquarters, and they basically said, okay, you know, you guys can compete for our business. Who's going to give us the biggest tax breaks? And corporations do this all the time. You know, what state is, we're going to site a car factory someplace. And, we'll give you $100 million in tax breaks. No, we'll give you $200 million. And on it goes. Ultimately, you know, who picks up the tab? We, the taxpayers. And the corporations are like, oh, we got all these great tax breaks and isn't everything wonderful. And the solution that Bernie Sanders suggested, which I thought was brilliant, was he said, let's take some kind of federal money that all the states want. It could be, now he suggested it would be transportation money, roads, because the federal funding for roads is major. Now, it could also be education funding, although, see, then you're hitting the kids. So I think Bernie's right, the roads. And let's just say that states who allow, states who participate in competition with other states to bring in factories or corporate headquarters or whatever and offer tax breaks, you can't make it illegal. But if states decide to do that, then they are not eligible for federal transportation money. Let's make it real simple. This is how they got a national speed limit. You can't go to a state and say, your speed limit must be 55 miles an hour. You can't do that. The Constitution doesn't give the federal government that much power. But the federal government does have the power to say, you want some money from us? Set your speed limit at 55. If you don't want federal highway funds, that's fine, no problem. You can have your speed limit be anything you want, because the, you know, the 10th Amendment says that. Basically, that any powers not given to the federal government are reserved to the states. So I think that that's a great strategy for doing it. So we'll see how it works out. Gary in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. I was just following up on Naomi Klein's discussion about the fact that, you know, what the cons like to call torture light is clearly as serious. And perhaps
even more serious. I mean, would you rather walk around missing one foot because it got chopped off in a torture session, or would you rather walk for the rest of your life? Or would you rather walk around for the rest of your life not knowing who you are?
Exactly. So, I mean, we learned that from the child abuse movement. We know it from domestic violence. I mean, short of death, all broken bones will heal, but the psyche is a lot more fragile. I understand that.
Yeah.
There's an article that just was run, and AP covered it, and I posted it at our website in the archives of general psychiatry just last week, that was done by a British group, and they looked at former Yugoslav prisoners. They had all been physically tortured, but they tried to parse out the effect of the psychological ill treatment, they called it, and indeed showed that it is as traumatic.
There are actually physiological changes that occur as a result of psychological activity, including psychological torture. You know, cortisol levels start spiking and the body starts breaking down and all kinds of physical things.
That's right. And Sapolsky's work on stress and how the hippocampus shrinks. We get involved with people traumatized from the workplace, which is hard for Americans to understand. The rest of the international industrialized world has done something about it in terms of legislation. But the parallel, however, is with this torture, and I think it's really important. And this article...
Gary, yes. What's the website where people can find it?
We've got to go to a break here. Bullyinginstitute.org. Bullying Institute.
Oh, okay. Bullying Institute.org.
That's it.
Great. Gary, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. I appreciate it and good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to the program there on Talk 1090. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
As I walked out tonight in the mystic garden, the wounded flowers were dangling from the vine. I was passing by a young cool crystal fountain. Someone hit me from behind. Ain't talking, just walking through this weary world of the world. Hot burning, still yearning. No one on earth would ever know.
Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical, well, what do you call us? When the majority of Americans agree with you on most issues, are you the left? Whatever. Tom Hartman here with you. 51 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Sarge in Columbia, Mississippi. Hey, Sarge, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you taking me on. I was just talking about the capitalistic system, global warming and stuff. A prime example of how screwballed free trade and can affect an area. Just look at the Mississippi coast. The reports now are that FEMA funds have been frozen. There's no more funds coming here. I was told that by a FEMA operator. Bush-Clinton funds have been frozen. The area is just in a world of chaos. We've got suicide rates well increased by 200%.
They're spiking. Yeah, yeah. This is all a great example, Sarge, of the old strategy of let's break government and then show everybody that it's broken and then claim government. Gee, government's broken. Let's give it to our crony friends instead.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the function may be.
I haven't got time to go into everything on this call, Tom, but if people go to unreportednews.net, I will be having a lot of information this week coming up on interviews I've done and some of the problems that, and actually fraud that's going on.
Great. Sarge, thanks a lot, and wish you well. John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. This thing, I know this is getting off topic a little bit, but this thing with Cheney and what he had said to the political action committee over there in Israel. It really bothers me that, the Democrats were voted in to do something. And they are in a majority. They need to stand up to this administration and this Republican Party and start calling them what they are. They need to say, you say that we are weak on terror. Well, if being weak on terror is not agreeing to have our injured soldiers come here and sit in their own fecal matter in a hospital that is not fit for an animal, then I don't want to be that type of supporter.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, John. And let's keep in mind that those hospitals or those facilities, those outpatient facilities, had been taken over by a private corporation that Dan Quayle is the chairman of the board of. I just don't understand why there's so little shrift given to that part of the story by the media and why nobody is asking Dan Quayle for an interview on this, you know, about his participation in this whole thing. But, John, good point, and thank you for making it. I appreciate it. Brian in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I think you could do even more shows on corporate non-identity, even though they claim to be, and also torture. It's really sad that that's such a big thing. It shouldn't exist.
We will be revisiting both topics on many occasions, Brian, I assure you.
Great. And one thing I wanted to ask, I may be incorrect, but I thought that with the Libya thing, with building a nuclear plant there, aren't we in Iran, don't you have to enrich the uranium before you get weapons grade? Isn't there?
Here's the difference. You have to, uranium, naturally occurring uranium is like something like 0.05% uranium, you know, in the ore. And so you've got to enrich the stuff up to 3% in order to create fuel for a nuclear power plant. So you have to enrich uranium, even if you just have a power plant.
Okay.
And the Iranians, what Mahmadinejad is saying is that, yes, he's enriching uranium to 3% for nuclear power plant.
Oh.
Now, if you want to make a bomb out of it, you've got to enrich it above 90%.
Okay.
And that's why it takes hundreds, thousands of centrifuges spending 24 hours a day for years to produce enough uranium for bombs. And particularly when you get into, and then if you want to make, plutonium bombs, you've got to run a nuclear power plant, and then you've got to figure out a way to extract the plutonium out of this spent fuel, because the plutonium is one of the consequences of the nuclear fission. There's a certain amount of fusion apparently that goes on in there as well that creates that plutonium. Iran is so far away from that.
And thanks for clarifying that.
Libya is going to have to begin enriching nuclear fuel.
Hasn't someone fairly reputable said Iran's at least 7 or 8 years at the minimum away from having
a bomb?
The
The Central Intelligence Agency and the International Atomic Energy Agency has also said that there's no evidence that they're building bombs, although, you know, you just never know. I mean, India built a bomb and we didn't know about it. We were surprised. Israel built a bomb. We were surprised.
South Pakistan,
you know, South Africa, another one. So you just never know. I mean, the question isn't, in my mind, you know, are they building a bomb or not? The question is, what kind of relationship are we going to have country to country so that whether they do or whether they don't, we'll have some say in how it gets used and how stable the region is. I mean, we need to be being, you know, decent neighbors throughout that region rather than being the guy who goes in there and just, you know, kicks over the hornet's nest and says, you know, good luck, everybody. It's just our absolute lack of any kind of coherent foreign policy is mind-boggling and breathtaking. It's absolutely consistent with the conservative idea that if government doesn't work, I mean, if you don't believe in government, how can you govern, right? I mean, there's just something really fundamental about that. Coming up Wednesday, tomorrow, Chris Edwards and I are going to talk about Democrats raising taxes, and Mike Farrell will be here on his new book, Call Me Mike. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.